Hello and welcome to Think Business Futures. We're coming to you from Tirisia in Sydney on the Gadigal lands of the Eora Nation. I'm Anthony Dockrell. Australia's relationship with our largest trading partner, China, has in recent times been a tense one. It's a relationship from Australia's perspective that has helped build unprecedented economic growth for both partners and was once described by former Prime Minister Tony Abbott as built on fear and greed. In recent times, this relationship has shown signs of improving, but recent debates around our universities and security shows that when it comes to China, moving this relationship forward may always be about two competing ideas, fear and opportunity. To discuss this and more, we are lucky to have Professor James Lawrenson, who is the director of the Australian-China Relations Institute. The Australian-China Relations Institute is an independent, non-partisan research institute established in 2014 by the University of Technology, Sydney. Professor James Lawrenson, welcome to Think Business Futures.
Great to be here.
Okay, so China is Australia's largest trading partner, something in the order of 40% of all our exports go to China. And since the Albanese government came into power, we've seen a reduction in the rhetoric and the heat in that relationship. Do we now have a healthy relationship with China, or do we still have a long way to go?
Look, I would describe it as it continues to be challenging, and that will always be the case. But look, that's been the case for the last 50 years that Australia has had diplomatic relations with China. We're obviously two very different countries, language, culture, history, political systems, to state the obvious. So this is never going to be an easy relationship. But the point is that for a long time, we've recognized that despite the challenges, it's a relationship that's worth working on because there's massive benefits involved as well. And you mentioned trade and, you know, just in 2023, two-way trade with China once again hit a new record high. So it's hard to argue with the data that that relationship is delivering positive benefits for Australia.
The relationship has been on a very bumpy ride of recent. I'm talking about the last 6 years. I'm thinking about Malcolm Turnbull when he was Prime Minister, and Australia banned Huawei from building our 5G network, and more recently with Scott Morrison and his rhetoric around COVID and China's role in the global pandemic. So this relationship has turned a major corner. Where do you think it'll go in the short term?
Look, I'm relatively optimistic. I've long had the view, and I think recent events have confirmed that over the last 18 months of the Albanese government, that diplomacy really does matter. You know, when I think back to the Turnbull and Morrison government periods, there were two things that caused the relationship to go into a tailspin. One was certainly China's own behaviour, right? And I don't want to, pretend that that didn't happen. It was aggressive. There were instances of Beijing breaking international rules and so on. But the other flip side, well, the other part of it was that you had some extraordinarily loose and unprofessional diplomacy on the Australian side. So what I think we've seen under the Albanese government is, the restoration, as Penny Wong says, and I think she's right. I don't just think this is a political talking point. She's restored calm and professional diplomacy, and that's helped to settle things down. So look, as we go throughout this year, the Chinese ambassador in Canberra has said publicly that he recognises that Australia and China still have differences. He says we even have disputes, but both sides agree to not let those disputes take over the entire relationship, and let's get on with focusing on areas of common interest. So that's where I expect the general trend to be this year, despite challenges.
And, you know, it's obviously a relationship we are still talking about and talking about regularly, but one thing I've noticed is that it's no longer on the front page week in, week out.
100%. And this is what I'm talking about when I say that calm and professional diplomacy has been restored. So Penny Wong and Anthony Albanese, they don't shy away from making clear their positions, right? So you would have seen, and your listeners would have seen the case of that Australian citizen, Yung Heng Jun, who received a suspended death sentence a couple of weeks ago. Albanese and Wong, they did not hide, I mean, they used words like appalling. They did not hide their disgust of that decision. But at the same time, they then didn't seek to spiral that rhetoric up in an ongoing way such that it overwhelmed the entirety of the relationship. And so Wong also said that, you know, we expect to have a visiting Chinese leader this year and that'll go ahead.
So where could we build closer ties with China in the short term?
Yeah, look, I think the people-to-people area is the obvious one to home in on. I mean, we've had, you know, the pandemic period where people-to-people ties were crimped for 3 or 4 years. I notice that Chinese international student numbers applying to study at Australian universities, they're now hitting record highs. They're actually higher than they were pre-pandemic. So tourism, education, and the basket of goods we trade with China continues to broaden as well. I mean, iron ore is the one that gets all the attention, but the bottom line is China is not just our major market for minerals, it's also our number one market for fuels, for critical minerals like lithium, for education, for tourism, for agriculture. It's across the board.
Look, it's fair to say China's economy is currently in a bit of a mess. There's been a lack of demand post-COVID lockdowns, and there's a property bubble which is currently imploding. There's other things we could talk about, youth unemployment and things like that. But are we seeing any impact on the Australian economy, seeing that China is our number one trading partner?
So first of all, I would agree with your assessment of the Chinese economy. I think it's probably in the poorest state that I've seen it in the 25 years I've been studying the Chinese economy. But I think the important thing for your listeners to understand is that there's never been, and there's certainly not now, a one-to-one relationship between economic ups and downs in China and China's demand for Australian goods and services. And I think the data point what makes that point, you don't need to look at Chinese economic data. You know, some people are a bit concerned about the quality of that. Look at Australia's own economic data from the Australian Bureau of Statistics. The Australian Bureau of Statistics says that our goods trade with China is now at a record high. As I said before, that basket of goods we trade with China is more diverse now than it's ever been, and services trade numbers are coming back as well. So look, Australia-China trade remains a healthy story despite the challenges of the Chinese economy.
So would you reject the idea that we are too dependent on China?
Yeah, I would reject that. Look, and again, we've got a great case study to deliver a pretty authoritative answer on this. In 2020, Beijing hit Australia with an unprecedented campaign of economic disruption, right? Beijing's disrupted trade with other countries before, but in Australia, we had about a dozen goods affected. You'd know the list: wine, barley, lobster, copper, cotton, and so on. But throughout that entire period, the total value of Australia's trade with China continued to set record highs. Now, why was that? Well, because the backbone of the trade relationship, China actually needs it from us just as much as we want to sell it to them. So it's a relationship of mutual interdependence. It's not one-sided dependence. And most of the other goods that China hit, coal, for example, barley, for example, they're actually traded in very open and competitive global markets. So when China said, we're not going to buy your coal anymore, most Australian coal producers just shrugged their shoulders and they sold to other countries. They had plenty of other markets that they could direct that output towards.
And talking of other markets, it strikes me that the Indian economy is going to grow over this century. So Australia's export mix is going to naturally diversify anyway.
Yeah, that's right. And of course, we want to add Southeast Asia to that list as well. So the intention should always be to diversify our markets. But at the same time, let's not pretend that we can overcome economic reality. I mean, I've heard some commentators suggest that Australian iron ore producers look for alternative markets. Well, if you look at global trade data, you'll find that China accounts for more than 80% of global iron ore imports. So if we're not selling to China, it's a mystery to me who else we could potentially sell to for that particular good.
So why all this hysteria around China, do you think?
Well, I think it arouses some strong emotions in folks for good reasons, right? There's plenty of stuff that China does that challenge Australian interests and that many Australians find personally very confronting. Me too, right? When it comes to human rights issues and so on. So it doesn't surprise me that we have strong reactions. But I think the mistake is to imagine that it's a simple story and China is just about human rights or it's just about the Chinese Communist Party, when in fact the relationship Australia has with China is a broad one. And frankly, many parts of the relationship are absolutely brilliant for Australian interests.
Look, if we went back to the 90s in a time machine, Australia had a relationship where it had one major trading partner and that was Japan. Were debates and discussions around that particular around that particular market, but the rhetoric was never the same, was it?
That's right, and I think that's got to do with a couple things. One is obviously Japan is a liberal democracy like we are, and China's not. It's a Chinese communist, you know, it's a one-party state, a communist party. So I think that adds some discomfort. And probably the second factor is that China is on a scale that makes it a peer of the United States. Now, of course, the United States is Australia's security ally. So that injects a bit more complexity into how we think about China, whereas Japan is obviously a firm American ally, just like we are.
Since the pandemic, there's been a lot of talk about building supply chain robustness, friendshoring, onshoring key industries. Do you see that actually happening in Australia? And do you think it's something that we should be exploring?
So just like we should try to diversify the markets we sell to, I think it's always wise to try to diversify our supply chain, so our import sources. But I think sometimes we can get a bit carried away. And if you actually look at the trade data, you find, despite all the talk, you find very little evidence that much is happening there. And here's the big factor that complicates that. China in 2024 is actually the global technology leader across a bunch of different areas, I think particularly when it comes to the energy transition. So, for example, if Australia is going to start, if there's going to be a lot more electric vehicles on Australian roads, China is the most, not just the most cost competitive, but it's actually the most technologically advanced producer of those vehicles. So it's not so easy as, you know, oh, well, we can just get from America or Japan. Well, no, we can't, because they don't produce the quality of stuff that China is producing.
And look, this loss of capacity is something I want to tease out a little bit more. But before we move on, I mean, Australia currently is, seeing the benefits of operating in a free and open global trading system. And yes, we do have to rely on countries like China, but they also have to rely on us. Isn't that a better relationship than us trying to bring everything home?
Yeah, 100%. And, you know, Penny Wong makes this point quite forcefully in a way that you won't hear Joe Biden or Washington putting it. You know, Penny Wong says that Australia's interests are served by being at every table where regional economic integration is being discussed. And so we're obviously in the World Trade Organization. We're in a whole bunch of other regional agreements like the RCEP agreement, the CPTPP, and then we've got a bunch of bilateral FTAs as well. And Penny Wong explains that for her, that's not just about prosperity, but those relationships of interdependence, as you said, not dependence, but interdependence. Penny Wong says that that's good for stability and security as well. I think she's exactly right. Now, of course, trade connections don't mean you can't have conflict with other countries, but it does inject cost. And so I think it does make capitals pause and be a bit more reserved in their decision making than they otherwise would be.
Now, look, the war in Ukraine, we should talk about that because it's kind of the other side of this argument. The war in Ukraine has shown that the West has a lack of industrial capacity and, you know, we simply can't make as much stuff as we used to. All that capacity is now sitting in China. Does the West have to restore some form of balance in this area, or do you think that's being too hawkish about the risk that, say, China might pose with a place like Taiwan?
Yeah, no, look, I think there's a sensible discussion to be had about production sovereignty. I think the issue in Australia is that we've got to be very cautious because we are only a country of 25 million people. And so if we start deciding we're going to produce electric vehicles, that does mean we're going to be pulling resources out of other sectors of the economy that we currently are in that actually deliver a lot of good for Australians. I think it's a lot easier for a country like the United States or indeed China to have that onshoring discussion. It's more of a challenge for Australia. I think for Australia, the focus should always be on making sure we have those diverse networks of suppliers rather than trying to bring everything back home.
And it does strike me too that the debate we're having here isn't on the same footing as the debate they're having in America, because America has still a fairly large industrial base. We kind of waved ours goodbye. Like, I clearly remember the treasurer, Joe Hockey, basically telling the car industry to go.
Yeah, and look, and even before then, I mean, if you look at the economic data, Australia actually lost most of its manufacturing sector in the 1970s, a bit more in the 1980s. By the 1990s, most of it had already left. So yeah, you're right. America's discussion is very different. And America is heading in a direction on trade policy that, frankly, is of great concern to Australia. I mean, America now has basically abandoned the World Trade Organization. And that's unfortunate because for a smaller power like Australia, we actually really, we haven't got just overwhelming power, right? So we do rely on international institutions and norms and rules such as the World Trade Organization to protect Australian interests. And the fact that our security ally is walking away from that system is pretty darn concerning.
Yes, and it does point to a picture where, you know, we could be in a future where we're relying, you know, basically of trading with friends and them trading with us. But a quick look at the data, I mean, America is way down the list when it comes to trading partners with Australia.
That's right. So there's a whole bunch of folks in the Australian commentariat, dare I say they're particularly from a national security and strategic background, who do imagine this wonderful world where we alleviate geopolitical risk in trade by simply trading with our mates. Well, that is just a joke. And if you ask a business person that, they'll tell you that's simply a recipe for cratering Australian prosperity. And as our trade values fall, we're not going to be doing any favours for our national security either. But if we're going to buy these nuclear-powered submarines, we've got to be able to pay for them. And vibrant trading relationships, including with countries like China, has got to be part of the mix.
Let's turn to your recent article in The Conversation. It was titled "Research Espionage is a Real Threat, but a Drastic Crackdown Could Stifle Vital International Collaboration." Now, there's been warnings for some time now that the state of our research is possibly under threat. Before we unpack your article and your arguments, let's talk about the nature of the problem. What exactly is research security?
Yeah, well, it's multifaceted, and that's why it's quite challenging to talk about this this topic. I mean, I work at a university, and the types of threats that I have to contemplate, the university has to contemplate, you know, they range everything from instances of IP theft, although I'd like to come back to that because I think that's often overdone, to foreign interference on campus, such as threatening some students, such that students don't feel as though they can raise their voice on a whole bunch of issues, or indeed academics. Academics get worried about what they can talk about in class because perhaps some students might complain or report them to their home country's embassy as, you know, and identify the academic as some, you know, threat to their home country's national interest. So it's a very broad mix of activities, and that's part of the challenge. But it also means that when we try to address this, you know, we can't just lump everything together as foreign interference. That's a massive mistake. We do have to take these issues one by one.
So, look, Australian universities make a sizable income through international students. And, our universities are aware of the risks that they face, in this contested global space we're talking about. Have they taken reasonable steps already to protect themselves and protect their research?
Yes, they have. And I'm not just saying that as a partisan academic employed by an Australian university. In fact, the evidence that they have has actually been delivered by Australia's own security agencies. So if you listen to what Mike Burgess, the Director General of ASIO, has to say, he says publicly on multiple occasions that he's very happy with the efforts universities have taken to manage this risk.
So ASIO is happy?
Indeed.
That sounds okay.
It does. And look, this is not just a one-off comment. I mean, in the article, in The Conversation, I actually tracked ASIO's comments, from Mike Burgess's comments, over a several-year period. He likes the path we're on. And he also says that far from being a laggard in recognising and responding to these threats, in fact, we're ahead of the curve. And I don't think that's quite as well known amongst the Australian public as it should be.
Look, one of the aspects that I think is important for us to talk about when we're talking about security and our universities is universities actually built on openness. If a physicist comes up with a new formula for understanding gravity, he doesn't turn around and say, sorry, it's a secret. He publishes it.
Exactly. So this is where the IP theft argument just simply falls apart, or indeed a lot of the espionage argument falls apart as well. So overwhelmingly, universities do not do classified research, right? So in other words, espionage is simply not relevant. And as you say, my incentives as an academic, and most academics, is to create knowledge and then push it out there into the public realm. China won't have to steal it. They can just read about our latest research published in international open access journals. And what's more, oftentimes Australian academics will be working with their colleagues in China and America, all put together on the same research team, to create this new knowledge for global benefit.
And look, you said that basically all research is open. I'm guessing there must be some circumstances where there is sensitive research happening at universities, but is that handled the same way as normal research?
No, of course not. So whenever you have classified research, for example, that is subject to a completely different array of mitigation measures by universities and by the Australian government as well. So it's not like someone can just walk into the average, you can't just walk into a lab doing classified research. It just simply is not set up that way.
Look, one of the other arguments I've seen put out there is that the AUKUS agreement that's recently been signed between Australia, the United States and United Kingdom will change the landscape, and Australia will have to get more serious and also will have to basically control the flow of information because of this deeper relationship we're going to get. Do you think that's the case, or again, is this kind of like just pushing the boat out too far?
So this is an actual area that's unfolding right now. So it's all in play. And in fact, there's some inquiries looking at this topic right now. But certainly I've spoken to a whole bunch of Australian scientists who are petrified that they'll be able to deal freely with their American and British counterparts, but it's going to become a whole lot more difficult to deal with everyone else. And that would be a tragedy, because obviously most of Australia's international scientific collaborations are not with just two countries, America and the UK. They're truly globalised. So that's the big risk. I think we'll have to see exactly where the government heads in terms of policies. Even with China, for example, I did some research back in 2020 and found that there are now more Australian scientific publications produced that include a Chinese co-author than an American one. So look, if we're going to section off a country like China, then the obvious effect of that isn't going to be to hurt China. It's going to be hurting ourselves, because in plenty of areas now, China is actually at the global technology frontier. We want to work with China because their scientists are the best. So we don't want to prevent our scientists from not being able to tap those networks and connections.
So look, it strikes me with this debate around research security, it's flowing out from the same debate really about friendshoring and onshoring. It's really kind of like an offshoot of that debate, isn't it? So fundamentally, it comes down to the kind of relationship we want to have with China. If you agree with that proposition, how do you think we should be approaching this issue in the medium term when it comes to when it comes down to research security?
Well, I think we should be dealing with it in the same way that we've dealt with it through trade. I mean, Australian companies are smart. Whenever they trade with China, they think about risk mitigations, they manage them, and they manage them extremely well, such that our two-way trade with China now is at a record high. Both sides are happy. So I think we need to have a sensible approach when it comes to research collaboration as well. Do we want to go into research collaborations with Chinese counterparts with our eyes wide open? Of course we do. Do we want to think about mitigations? Of course we do. And that's exactly what we're doing. But once you've ticked the due diligence box and ticked the transparency box, then I think we need to just have some faith in our scientists to get on with the job. I mean, the idea that some bureaucrat sitting in Canberra knows the best way to direct our scientists in terms of where they should focus their energy. I mean, just how ridiculous, right? I mean, it's the scientists who know who the best people in the world, in their field are. And I think we need to let them get on with the job.
And, you know, if we are moving forward in this century and we have a lot of challenges to deal with, it would seem a little bit, foolish to lock ourselves away from basically a billion people who are working on similar problems that we are.
Yeah, and a country that is now spending $600 billion on R&D every year. That compares with $30 billion in Australia. A single Chinese company, Huawei, now spends more on research and development than all Australian businesses combined. So look, cutting ourselves off from China would just be a massive own goal. And don't imagine the rest of the world is going to do it. I mean, if you look, even America, there's plenty of American scientists and European scientists, Japanese scientists who remain dead keen on collaborating with China because they know that's the best path forward for their particular research area.
So if someone's listening to this and they're just basically getting their head around what's going on here, what would be the simple message that you'd want them to take away from our discussion today?
The China relationship is a broad one. And oftentimes you do have to be capable of holding, I wouldn't say contradictory thoughts in your head, but you've got to be comfortable dealing with complexity. So I don't deny there are challenges when it comes to human rights or China's actions in the South China Sea and so on. But if you obsess on that and just imagine the entirety of the relationship is that, you're going to be ignoring reality, and you're also going to be cutting Australia off from a whole lot of benefits in other areas. Trade is obviously one. People-to-people ties is obviously another one. And China's not going away, right? So whether we like it or not, China will be the dominant state in the part of the world that we live in. So let's at least manage the relationship in a way that keeps things constructive.
Professor James Lawrenson, thank you for being on Think Business Futures.
My pleasure.
And thanks for listening to the program. This edition was recorded at the studios of 2OCR and is made possible by the assistance of the UTS Business School. If you wanted to listen to this program again or share it with your friends, just go to 2OCR.com or you can find us wherever you get your podcasts. Think Business Futures will be back next week. I'm Anthony Dockrell. Thanks for listening.